Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I think let's start. Time is not. Can we allow the moment of silence for a prayer, please? Thank you very much. Oh, there's people next to me. I think that might be doing not close. There's a little bit of noise. Ladies and gentlemen, you are most welcome to this meeting of Security and Justice, which we are visited by the Department of Defense today. I think put your jackets off, relax, ask questions, deliberate, and discuss and ask clarity. You are welcome to this meeting. Let's proceed to the apologies. Are there any apologies?
Yes. Honorable Mohapi is currently in hospital, and the Honorable Wana, she's unable to attend today. So those are two apologies.
Thank you. Member of Defense, do we have any apologies?
Good morning, Chair and President and Committee members. I have an apology for the Secretary for Defense, who had intended to be here, but because of urgent commitments that he had to attend to, so he couldn't make it. So I'm here representing him. Thank you.
The Chairperson
of Insurance, yes, sir.
The apology, I have to leave at 11 if we're not done.
No problem,
sir.
Yes, sir. Members, this is our agenda for today. If any additions from this agenda, we'll accept it. I give the chance to the members if they want to add anything to this agenda. If not, can we adopt the agenda as it is? Sir, honorable member. Don't have the mic next to you, then.
By the way, it should be audible.
Chair, I will move a motion to adopt the agenda. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Now, we are in item number 3, where we need to know who is here, who is not here. Thank you. I would like the members to introduce themselves, but let me start with the Department of Defense to introduce the members.
Thanks, Chair, again. My name is Dumisani Dlala. I am, by position, Chief Director Strategic Manager in the department. I work, amongst other things, with the management of arms transfers in South Africa, as well as the execution of South Africa's obligations under quite a number of treaties, including the ones on the table. With me, therefore, I've got two colleagues of mine who are part of the department, as well as other two who are also the administration part of the department. I'll ask them to introduce themselves. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Colonel Nigel FC. I'm a technical advisor for arms control attached to the Secretariat for Defense.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Sipho Mashaba. I'm a Deputy Director of Compliance Arms Control.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Rejima Mimi, Director Parliamentary Liaison Officer, Office of the Sector.
Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Freddy Mpetele Lukumalo. I'm the PLO to the Minister of Defence and Military Veterans.
Thanks, Chairperson. You know, like I can Maslam Rawana to be here, member of this committee, agent from the Fort.
What is it? My name is Luis Dimande.
I'm asked to share with Hoshi. I thought I'll share with my colleague the mic. I don't have it, but I'm a member of the committee. I'm representing KZN in the committee. Thank you, sir.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, sir. Ke na ha le re se manopole ke le bula komiti ke le bo.
Morning, chief, and everybody. Yeah, my name is Moses Tatasulanga from Mpumalanga, a member of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, chief. Good morning. Jacques Julius, member of the Properties Housing Programs.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, officers. My name is Malin Chedi, KZN Government Delegate, suburbs of Nkagwa.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is George Michalakis. I'm the permanent delegate from the Free State.
Good morning.
Thank you. My name is Dumisani Kingi, permanent delegate from the Western Cape, originally from the Eastern Cape. Thank you. Our support officers around, our colleague advisor next to me.
Let's proceed, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I would like to take this opportunity to ask the Department of Defense on the convention on, Department of Defense to brief us on the convention on cluster munitions tabled in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution of 1996. Defense, I would like you to table this in front of this committee and to hand over to you, sir.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. As directed, therefore, I shall proceed to the presentation on the Convention on Cluster Munitions. I think I share everyone has got a copy of the presentation in front of themselves, and I shall therefore use that as a basis of the presentation. I think by way of introducing this matter, Chair, therefore, I wish to indicate that this cluster munition convention is a convention that South Africa signed in 2018, December of 2008. And we did so in South Africa because we have therefore assessed and found it necessary as a country to sign this treaty because it speaks to some of the interests that we have as a country, particularly around the use of particular kinds of our weapons, like cluster munitions, which are by design are very instrumental when they are used. And it's very important, therefore, that we act in concert with the rest of the world to try to eliminate these weapons as weapons of choice during combat. There are certain provisions, therefore, of the treaty which are stating certain obligations for the country. And one that I'm just highlighting under the introduction is that Article 16 of the convention, therefore, says once the country signs this convention, it is therefore for that particular country required to basically take that convention through a ratification process through its own parliament. So we are therefore here because we accept that in South Africa we have got parliament that therefore carries the responsibility to ratify this particular treaty. I am just on the subsequent bullet points here, just speaking to some of the provisions of the Constitution around international agreements. And I think I have just noted therefore here that the committee is quite familiar with these particular provisions of the Constitution. But what it therefore says to us is basically that once the treaty has been signed, it only becomes law in South Africa if it has been ratified firstly by Parliament, and secondly, it has been enacted into domestic legislation. So we accept that. Therefore, the reason that we are here is because that we want to give expression to that particular provision of the Constitution by virtue of requesting the approval of this convention by Parliament, and COP being one of the houses of Parliament. The chair, therefore, during the negotiations of the cluster munitions, because it is a product of negotiations, it just came about because there were discussions between quite a number of states. But our participation, therefore, in those negotiations as a country, South Africa, excuse me, sir, was basically informed by quite a number of what I would define as particular interest. One of it, as a country, we had taken a view that says from a defense perspective, that cluster munitions, by virtue of them being very inhumane when it comes to these implications, it's no longer constituting part of the Defense Department or SANDF war strategy. It therefore means that the SANDF, if it therefore works out on strategy of combat engagement, will therefore not identify cluster munition as part of that because of its characteristics, as indicated over here. But the other interest that we had during the negotiations as guiding our approach there too, was the negative humanitarian implication that these cluster munitions have. Because all that it does, they are very unreliable. And as such, therefore, they are very indiscriminate. And here, therefore, maybe the word discrimination and indiscrimination becomes very particular here, because maybe it's one time when I would call for a discrimination to happen in weapons, because weapons have got to be able to discriminate between combatants and non-combatants. So therefore, the cluster munitions are therefore not discriminating. They are very indiscriminate. So they can just affect about everybody who comes across them. And because of that, therefore, we felt that these are the measures that we need to uphold. And lastly, and the other interest is arising out of foreign policy interests of South Africa, that as a country, we adopted a position as a country that says we want to pursue the agenda of general disarmament and effective arms control as a country. You would want to support all efforts that seek to bring about disarmament. But in the event where you therefore require to use weapons, you need therefore to have strong regulations around. And because of his interest, which has indicated, South Africa therefore felt that we had to subscribe to this particular treaty. And in 2008, therefore, as you would know, agreements before they could be signed, they need to be sanctioned by the president. The president, therefore, in 2008, on advice by the Defense Department and Foreign Affairs at the time, before it became legal, and therefore advised that it is prudent to join this particular treaty, and as such, therefore, it was indeed joined. Last year, when we were preparing to introduce or table this convention here for ratification, we had again sought the reconfirmation of the cabinet position on the matter. And the cabinet, therefore, last year, as late as last year, reconfirmed its position of 2008. So it means from an executive perspective, South Africa feels that this treaty is still a request, and South Africa needs therefore to take it through the ratification process. But Chair, therefore, what is key in this matter is that what happens after we have ratified this treaty, because that is what is very key. That much as we are here today, but if we do obtain the ratification, what would happen afterwards, therefore, is first thing. We are required in terms of the provision of the treaty to deposit what's called the instrument of ratification with the UN. We are required to do so. That, therefore, will be done by the Department of Foreign Affairs, or International Relations and Cooperation, as they are called now. And secondly, the other requirement, therefore, is to ensure that we establish or we therefore draft a legislation that will be a domestic legislation to give expression to the provisions of the treaty in South Africa. And we're saying so because therefore of the specific provisions of the Constitution. Maybe I may have to correct over. It should be section 234 of the Constitution as opposed to 231, 3. So it's actually 4, which calls for that. But we are aware of that requirement, therefore. We are just waiting for ratification to happen. Once that happens, we've already got a draft of legislation on the table, which we shall therefore start to introduce to Parliament for approval through the normal processes. But once we have therefore done that, we would have, as a country, therefore, fulfilled our obligations under the Convention. However, I wish therefore to bring a context of international humanitarian law, because the cluster munitions are a set of or is one instrument under a particular body of law, and I think it's important that we understand the context within which this arises. I'm talking about slide number 6 of the presentation now. It's and I'm, we are indicating there that the convention forms part of international humanitarian law. And that IHL is basically the, is a set of rules that seek for humanitarian reasons to limit the effects of armed conflict. It basically means that this is part of international law that therefore comes into play when there is a conflict that is raging. When there is no conflict that is raging, this part of law is not in force. However, it becomes applicable therefore once there is a war, because it seeks therefore to limit the effects of armed conflict on non-combatants to a large extent. But the other thing that is it's part of our humanitarian law is it protects people by restricting the methods as well as the means of war. When you're talking about methods and means of war basically says these are the options or the weapons that you have to choose from. But secondly, when you're talking about methods of war, you're talking about the tactics that you therefore adopt to tackle a particular situation. So what IHL therefore says is that in the process of deciding on the kind of weapons that we are to use, as well as the tactics to apply, your right of doing so is not unlimited. You are restricted. You can't just choose any weapon. You've got to make a particular assessment and therefore choose the right weapon. And second, you must ensure therefore that the tactics that you therefore apply do not unnecessarily cause what we'll call later a superfluous injury, or as well as unnecessary pain, as it were. So we are therefore concluding on slide number 6 by saying that the choice of weapons is not unlimited. You shall always have limitations on how to use weapons. The key principles therefore of IHL is are the ones that are indicated there. I think just to make that much more stronger and clearer, it is to therefore say that whilst you are looking at those methods and weapons, what is key is that in creating, in actually choosing the weapons and tactics, you must therefore ensure that you do not unnecessarily cause suffering as well as inflict superfluous injury. That is excessive injury. Because the intention of war, Chairperson, in the context of the Geneva Convention, is to actually render the other party ineffective. It is not to destroy it, but it's to actually render them ineffective so that they can be arrested as prisoners of war. And if you have that maxim in mind, you shall therefore be very selective in the kind of weapons that you use. But secondly, the issue of discrimination. In the raging of a conflict, you must therefore be able to separate combatant soldiers as well as non-soldiers, so that when you are targeting particular enemies, those should be those that are combatants, not civilians. We know, therefore, Chair, that many of the conflicts, the people who suffer the most are the non-combatants. And what we therefore want to do in terms of the IHL is to actually get into a stage where only the people who are combatants are therefore an object of an attack as opposed to any other person. And proportionality is another point that is key over here, that whatever weapon that you use, the tactic, it should be in direct proportion to the military advantage that you're going to get. Or secondly, it should also be in proportion to the level of threat that you are facing. As an example, Jefferson, I think if you were to have a 12-year boy who would walk into a military store and steal a lollipop, the owner of the shop cannot therefore be justified if we were to take a bazooka and take that boy out. Because that would be excessive. He will therefore have to choose a weapon that is proportionate to the level of threat that he is facing. So you therefore find that in the legal fraternity, the whole issue of threat and proportionality becomes very, very, very key. But IHL therefore has that as a maxim to say. Proportionality is very relevant. An issue of environment, that you are not therefore to destroy the environment. If you are targeting somebody, you cannot therefore destroy parliament, destroy about everything. You must target certain areas. There's quite a number of instruments of IHL. I think it was slide number 8, we are therefore indicating a whole range of them. There's quite a number of them. And they are all falling under the United Nations. So these are placing obligations on states to conduct. But the point that I was making, Chair, therefore, is that the class ammunition therefore forms part of the body of international humanitarian humanitarian law, and as indicated on slide number 8, as well as slide number 9. But the background, in the context of that, with this particular background, the background to the class animation debate started because of particular reasons. One is, class animation, because of their character, had therefore become stigmatized, meaning they became bad people. And if they are bad people, therefore, it's because they cause, they are very inhumane in application, as well as they can cause enormous unnecessary injuries. The Department of Defense in South Africa, including other government agencies and defense forces across the world, has therefore identified this report as not right, as bad, and as such, therefore, it should not therefore be used in operations. And because of that stigma, therefore, South Africa signed this treaty and joining other defense forces in the world who are also of the same mind. The chair, for a moment, therefore, I'll hand over to Senelasi, who is a technical advisor of mine, to explain what these class animations are and how they work in an area of conflict. He's a military man, and he has used these things in the past, so he's quite familiar. I'm just saying, by virtue of either handling them or the, but he's a man who's familiar with how they are. Exactly.
Thank you, Jeff. Yes, if we go to slide 11, I have to maybe draw an analogy because it will help one think. If we see cluster munitions as a concept, then you can imagine a dustbin full of hand grenades, to give you an idea. And then when you're flying over a target, you would tip this dustbin of hand grenades over your target, and they would spread everywhere, and everybody would get a piece of hand grenade at some stage down the line. So that's effectively the cluster munition as a concept, and is this container that contains these hand grenade-sized munitions. They stem from back in the first used by the Germans in World War II over England, and then subsequently in the Vietnam War they were dropped over targets in Vietnam, and in the Cold War they were also preparing for mass tank attacks from the Russians and from the West, and the idea at that stage was to stop a tank attack, you throw lots of these little devices, and some of them are even smaller than this bottle of cool drink we have in front of us. And they are so powerful that they can punch a hole through 70 millimeters of armor plate. So if you are in your tank, this will come through your tank if it lands on you. So if you throw them like a hailstorm over charging tanks, some of them are going to hit those tanks and come through the tank and do damage and maybe reduce the combat effectiveness of that tank. And then of course, the name given to cluster munitions has got a size limit, and the upper limit of that is 20 kilograms. So if this bottle weighs 20 kilograms and you throw them out of a dustbin, for example, then they have the name cluster munitions. And that's where, and these individual items are called submunitions. Each little hand grenade is like a submunition. So, once they leave their dustbin, for example, their container, they are unguided. They just go where they fall. And they have no intelligence. They don't know what they're looking at or anything like that. So they just hit the ground and explode. Or if they hit the target, you're lucky for that. If then it hits the target. Then if we go to slide 12, you can see an example of the actual, in this case, they can be carried by aircraft, or they can be sent by missile, or they can fire by artillery shell. In this case, in slide 12, we see a missile that's opening up, it's been released by the aircraft over the target area. The missile then opens up and then releases these great black containers, each submunition. And then on slide 13, you can see another example of a missile warhead that's got lots and lots of these little ones. They come in different shapes and sizes. As you see there, they're little round balls in this case. And then on slide 14, you see them packed into an artillery shell. This is similar to the type of artillery shell that was developed in South Africa in the 80s, and which is no longer under development. And then on slide 15, this is a typical example of one that's designed to punch a hole through a tank armor. As you can see, it fits easily in your hand. That particular size is roughly about the size of a cocktail Coke tin. So it gives you some idea of the size there. That particular shape is a copper, there's a copper funnel inside there with the explosive around it. And when it detonates, it effectively fires a hot copper jet at about 6 kilometers per second through that armor plate. And it's traveling so fast that it sees that armor plate as a hot knife in butter. It just goes right through. So that is the technology that's involved. When it explodes, also, if there are people sitting on the tank, when it does fire this little jet of copper into the tank, people sitting on the tank or around the tank will also get hit by the casing as it explodes, and they will get small fragments in them as well, so that will reduce their fighting efficiency. Then we say, well, why did the military like them? And one of the main considerations was they were cheap, basically cheap and very nasty. They covered a wide area, so if you've got a target in an area and you threw a carpet of these things, you would hit something and knock out that area. That effective against massed armored vehicle formations, as in the Warsaw Pact type of war that was envisaged for mass tank attacks. It was good for that. And as I said, many were produced. There are hundreds of millions of these things probably in stock around the world that still have to be destroyed. And it's a very expensive process to destroy them. It costs more to destroy them than it does to build them in the, based on the cost. So what is wrong with them? Well, one of the chief things is that they're inaccurate because they've been thrown effectively out of a container or a dustbin over a target area. They can land anywhere. So if you have an enemy that's close to civilians, they will spread into that area depending on how the pilot flies his aircraft. Also, when a pilot is approaching a target and he's being shot at, he's moving through the air taking evasive action. When he lets that weapon go, he doesn't necessarily let go at the right place and time because he's also ducking and diving bullets. So he might just let go too late or too early and then they could land over a civilian area like a hospital or a school. So that was one of the problems with accuracy. And then the other problem is they are unreliable. Because they're so cheap and nasty in the old days, they didn't all go off when they hit the ground. If they land in mud, or they land in a tree, or they land in deep snow, they might not detonate. And the problem then is it kills and maims civilians years after that conflict. Like even in Vietnam now, still children are still getting maimed and killed from these things because from back from the Vietnam War, because they lie in wait. Farmers come and uncover them when they're plowing their lands and stuff like that. As I say, it's also dangerous. They're difficult to clear the unexploded ones. So if you have them lying on the ground, you know it's there, it's still difficult to get to it because the fact that it can cut through 70 millimeters of armor plate, when you go to it to deal with it and it's sensitive, it might just go off while you're approaching or while you're driving. So it's a very dangerous weapon as well. And then they're prolific. In the old days, everybody had these things, and they're still battling to get rid of them. And so they've been used in 37 countries, and so there's a lot around. So that was also a problem with them. And if you see slide 18 is a typical example of a child that's had his arms blown off from playing with these things, attractive to children. There's a slide 19 is an example of unreliability. This canister never opened and hit the ground, and these things never exploded. So, and then, of course, you see it's dangerous to clear. It's very labor intensive to find these things and then deal with them. And on slide 21, you can see how prolific they are. There are just fields of these things in some places.
I think share that with that particular background, we do realize how bad these weapons are. However, then I will start with slide number 22, where we're talking about how the process of assassination that was started to establish the treaty. Obviously, in the UN, one of the difficulties of the UN operation is that it works on the basis of consensus. And consensus that will say that every party in that discussion must therefore agree. You may find that 180 countries agree on a particular thing, but two say no. Therefore, you can't adopt that because you have not reached consensus. There's a whole debate around how you define consensus versus
substantial consensus or sufficient consensus. But the long and short of it is that some of the very good discussions at the UN, they just fall flat because one country can block quite a number just by saying no. So as a result of that, during the discussion that were at the UN at the time, we only had everyone else supporting that there should be a treaty to eliminate these reforms. But there were a few countries who opposed it. One of them at the time was USA, Russia, China, India, Pakistan, and others. And because of that, therefore you can't adopt a convention. And therefore Sweden at the time had, not Sweden, but Norway, therefore decided to run a process outside of the UN to actually try to get the like-minded countries to start to negotiate that, with an idea of actually trying to stigmatize gas and munitions, first and secondly, to indirectly force those who are opposing it to join it. Because once in the open, it becomes very difficult, you become very unpopular as a country to stand up and say, we still like gas and munitions. I think no one says that. But in closed doors at the UN, people would oppose gas and munitions, but they would not take the risk of standing outside and saying it is required. So therefore, Norway therefore started that process, and it led therefore to about 93 countries to sign the treaty. And South Africa being one of us, Kenneth Apsley next to me here and myself were part of that process in 2008. Therefore, here are the key provisions of the treaty, Chair. I think it's important that we just highlight on those. We are not indicating all the provisions of the treaty, but we're just highlighting the important ones so that you understand what it is that the treaty says, but that will be done in a moment. But firstly, as you can see on slide number 23, it says it prohibits explosive submunitions of up to 20 kg. So you've got this particular threshold. So if anything, therefore, fits that particular threshold, therefore, it is basically prohibited, not allowed. However, there are exclusions to that. The exclusions, therefore, are that when you've got the newest version of class ammunition, which are called smart submunitions, those are therefore not prohibited because those have got an advantage of they can see. It means they can look for something, they can engage a target. And when they have missed the target, they will self-destruct and self-deactivate. So the difficulty that Kenneth Apsley was indicating that some of these things can lie waiting for you for 20 years will not therefore be applicable to this kind of clusters, because those are by design. They put in some mechanics inside that after a particular number of hours, it will automatically explode. So it does not wait for many years, but it's very specific. When you direct that to a target, it will therefore go to the target. And obviously, once you speak about that, you realize how expensive that will therefore become. If it becomes very expensive, many countries therefore begin not to buy them because they are very costly. As opposed to the previous ones, as Kenneth Apsley was saying, that they were easier to, they were very cheap to manufacture but expensive to destroy. The smart ones are basically very expensive to manufacture because they are relying on ICT. So those are therefore excluded from that. But the treaty also talks about victim assistance because it accepts therefore that there are people who are therefore victims of class ammunition, and therefore once you are a state party to the treaty, you must therefore take some proactive action to ensure that people who are victimized by class ammunition are indeed therefore taken care of and they are properly rehabilitated. Stockpile destruction is another provision of that if you are a state party, you are therefore required to destroy these weapons 8 years after it has come into force in India. That basically means that if South Africa ratifies the treaty, we will have 8 years within which to destroy our own mines, our own class ammunition, not mines, class ammunition. And I think later in the presentation, shall therefore indicate the kind of class ammunition we have in South Africa, because we have them. And I think we have to say that. However, then once we ratify, we shall have an obligation to destroy them within a particular timeline. Slide number 14, Chair, just basically speaks about these issues of what are the prohibited mines versus those that are permitted. The smart ones versus probably the opposite of that would be the unsmart mines. The other provision of the treaty on slide number 25, Chair, therefore, is about that states, if you are a state party to that, you have ratified it, you are therefore prohibited from persuading other state parties to violate the convention. you cannot be a state party to the convention, but still ask other people to use these lines, because it therefore undermines your whole commitment to the cause of prohibition. The clearance of remnants is another provision that is very key. That you are required to ensure that remnants are basically are the remains of our business. Once they lie in the ground, they become remnants. And you have therefore an obligation to clear those areas within a particular period of time. The other provision talks about sharing of information, which basically says that you are to share information, because class of munitions are basically used in times of war. And in times of war, certain territories are assumed by the victors. And at the time of their withdrawal some other time, they would have the drawings where these things were deployed. And if they don't tell you that we've deployed these mines over here, when you return there, you shall be blasted. So that's why therefore the issue of sharing information becomes absolutely key. As an example, I'm making an example. I'm not suggesting that these were used elsewhere. During the Bush War, you will therefore find that South Africa was active in the Northwest Africa, Angola, and all of that. The SADF at the time will therefore have maps of where some of these things were used. At the point of withdrawal, so the people coming back, they will not know where they are. Therefore, South Africa, if they had used tough ammunition, will therefore be under an obligation to share that information with the people who are returning. That provision therefore deals with that particular question. The other one is about reporting compliance. Once you join, you are required therefore to provide reports to the UN on a yearly basis, indicating what you have done, indicating what you are doing about it. You are destroying the mines if you have them, and ensure that the reports are done according to the precise format. Legislation is another requirement, as indicated. The treaty recognizes that you are to establish a mechanism in your own country. And the reason behind it is very simple. If you look at the provisions of any treaty, the majority of the treaties, you cannot be able to enforce that in a particular jurisdiction without domesticating it. Because a treaty does not talk about offenses and crimes and penalties and all of it. So if you have to take a person and try to charge a person on the basis of a treaty, you may not be able to win the fight. But you need, therefore, through a domestic legislation, to define a prohibition as an offense and as a crime, subject to a particular penalty, and. So that's why the issue of domestication becomes absolutely key. The other point here, which is very interesting to me, is that a state party may not derive benefit. What it basically means is that state parties, South Africa, can participate with other countries in a particular conflict. You can be deployed in a particular part of the world, and in that deployment you may be with other countries, and some of them may not be parties to the treaty. And therefore you've got a dilemma. Because they may choose to use the class of munitions. But you are therefore supposed to persuade them not to use them, firstly. But secondly, you may not derive the benefit from that. You can't therefore say, I, in South Africa, I'm a state party to this, I cannot use class of munitions, but my friend, please use them and give me cover. Yeah. So you can't use that, because you are therefore undermining again your commitment to the code. Slide number 27, the co-chair, talk about states that or countries that were affected by class of munitions. That is where class of munitions were used. And if you look at that list, from Vietnam to Yemen, there's quite a number of countries there. Iraq being another one, Afghanistan, Syria, the DRC, Eritrea, Lebanon, to mention quite a few. All these countries are affected by clusters. They've got clusters lying somewhere. And the states are the countries that, at the present moment, there's about 115 states that have joined the treaty. There's 84 that are state parties now who have ratified. There's 29 who are still to ratify. And South Africa, therefore, has joined, but still has to ratify, and that is why we are here, person, so that because we want to join the elite group of the 84. Slide number 29, so we talk about countries that use class ammunition. These are countries that have used class ammunition in the past, in terms of history. And sadly so, but South Africa was one of the countries that used class ammunition. As you can see over there, the Saudi Arabia, the South Africa, unfortunately. So South Africa, therefore, has used class ammunition in the past. And therefore the issue of us sharing information, the issues of reporting and destruction as obligations becomes very pertinent. Slide number 30 talks about the countries that produced. Those are the countries that made this report. And again, South Africa, by virtue of the defense industry in South Africa, we produce them. We are cited again the next to Slovakia and South Korea. And you can see over there, there's quite a number of countries, USA, UK, and others, who produced this thing in the past. So the treaty therefore becomes very, very pertinent to all these countries. Slide number 31 therefore talks about countries that therefore bought the class ammunition and stockpiled them as weapons of war. Then this whole list, South Africa obviously is another country that is there. We've got the cluster munition. Actually, in the subsequent slide, talk about the kind of clusters that we have in our arsenal. And slide number 32, they talk about states that have not joined. These are states that have decided to stay outside of this. And as you can see, all of them, and each one of them will have a particular character. And obviously, countries would make a determination whether they want to join. But it is therefore an encouragement by the UN that if you are to achieve universalization of treaties, everyone must encourage to join. So in our bilateral engagement with other countries through foreign affairs, we encourage these countries to join because we see a greater benefit in the cluster munitions. Slide number 33, the talks about the implications for South Africa. I think I've referred to this point previously, that once we ratify, we shall have 8 years to destroy our own cluster munitions. Our assessment, the Pacheco, is that we have got a relatively small stockpile of cluster munitions in the SANDF. What we've got 179 delivered cluster munitions. Those are air delivered cluster munitions. Those are the ones that we can deploy by an aircraft. And there are some that we can deploy through artillery, through the shells. So we have those. We have made an assessment. We've got numbers very clear. And the cost of destroying them is estimated, obviously the figure will change from time to time, but it are estimated that it could be in the region of around about two million rand or just about that. But that is our assessment at the present. Obviously, at the time of destruction, we have to reassess the situation. This was done in 2008, as number so obviously, there could have been inflation that is accrediting as a consequence of that. 33, therefore, talks about development and production stopped. South Africa has got a strong defense industry. Therefore, South Africa does not develop and produce such munitions since we signed the treaty. And you'll ask the question here, how are we certain about that? We are certain, therefore, because there is a defense industry that is, therefore, controlled through a particular arms control process. There has been a directive given to the industry to discontinue that. But you discontinue because it is not yet binding. But you encourage them to discontinue. But from an arms transfer perspective, South Africa, through the NCECC, has not authorized any transfer of cluster munitions since 2008 because we are committed to the cause of cluster munitions. But obviously, once you ratify, it's no longer an encouragement. It's actually a total ban. You can't do that. Test ranges, we've got test ranges where the cluster munitions were tested. And one of them is owned by AMSCO, Alcan Pan in the Northern Cape. Clearance of the cluster munitions that we deployed over there is currently going on. And the other one is about troops cannot ask for direct cluster munition use. It's a point I made earlier that you can't encourage other people to cover through the use of cluster munitions whilst you are saying you uphold the principles of cluster munitions. And the last one is you cannot trade. Once you ratify, you can't trade. You cannot trade. So we are using, therefore, the NCECC, which I'm going to explain to when you come to the ATT, how it basically works. So there is no exportation, importation, transit of cluster munitions in the South African territory because of our commitment to this particular measure. Victim assistance, Chairperson. Cluster munitions were used by South Africa, not in South Africa. You know, they were used by South Africa outside of South African territory. So you don't have victims in South Africa of cluster munitions. You could potentially have them outside of the South African territory. However, if they were to be present in South Africa, we are supposed to deal with them in terms of the provision of the Constitution, Chairperson. I think there's a section there about equality and access to health and all of it. but that is how we should have. It's an obligation that we have to deliver on. The last slide, the question talks about the way ahead. How do we therefore move forward? And the thing therefore, once Parliament has ratified through its own processes, we shall therefore lodge this instrument of ratification with the UN Secretary as the person who is in charge of that process. We shall, as a country, participate in discussions in the UN around these matters, because there are yearly conferences that happen, and we are party to those particular discussions, so that we are able to share information and share experiences and practices. And we shall therefore, after that, also destroy or get into a destruction mode of the cluster munitions that I said we have in our arsenal. So Chair, therefore, in summary, this is how the treaty works. And these are the obligations that it places on our shoulders, and we are therefore submitting that we request the ratification or support by this committee to have this treaty ratified. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Members, I don't know whether we can ask questions or we can proceed and ask questions later after this item number 5. What is the feeling? What is the feeling of the members? Get another presentation, ask questions. Yes.
Thank you. I'm proposing that we can to ask questions now before we proceed to another one. Unless we are going to advise candidates the relationship between this presentation and the other presentation.
Is there any relationship between these two presentations?
Chair, I support the view of dealing with the questions now. They are related, but they are not dependent on each other. Yes.
Thank you. Over to you, Honourable Members. Can you just ask questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is under, I think it's slide number 33, with regards to find out whether after ratification, are any penalties with regards to those in the country producing, because now you are saying that we are encouraging them not to produce. But after ratification, they're supposed to comply not to produce or to manufacture the sub-administration. So just want to check whether after ratification, should it happen that other companies like kitchens, if you don't have such costs, that will be penalties for them to be able to. So I just want to find out. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have just two short questions. When last did we use these? I gather it's quite a few years ago. The other thing is, you spoke about how much it will cost to destroy it, but how do we go about destroying these weapons? What is the methods and the processes used? Those are my only two questions. Thanks.
Yes, can you just explain the impact of terrorist organizations on this? Because it's a concern to me that we are opening ourselves on this. What's your stance on that? Can I just get some information on that? I'm not an expert. I just need to know, man, because I'm scared. Really scared. Thank you. And especially after I heard a needle can shoot through such things.
Thank you, Chair. My name is I just need clarity. Why did it take South Africa so long to, I don't know what word are you using, to comply or to sign? We joined in 2008, right? Then it took us almost 9 years, if I'm not mistaken. 2008 up until, let's say, 2013, then, as a full year, not to just complete the whole process. Why did it take so long? Because in your presentation, you say to destroy it needs 8 years, and there is budget implications there. The longer we wait, the more money we'll use to destroy as a country. So I just need that clarity. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll respond to some of the questions I have, but I'll share some with Kenneth Afshin. But to start with the first question about the issue of ratification, what happens before, after ratification, in terms of dealing with those who therefore not comply with ratification? I think the answer to the question lies in the issue of enactment of domestic legislation. That is why we have therefore said that once it's ratified, we shall therefore bring to Parliament a piece of legislation that therefore says, talks about transfer nations. It shall therefore define the crime and therefore say, here are our prohibitions. You shall not manufacture, you shall not export, you shall not... So if you are therefore found to have done these particular activities, that will constitute an offense. And the offense therefore shall be punished through imprisonment of how many number of years and this and that and the other. So I think the answer lies therefore in legislation. We've got ideas about how we need to deal with that. If we just take a cue from the other conventions that we have dealt with, so we can create crimes and offences and penalties, and make it not an encouragement, but make it an offence if you are exporting or you are found in possession of this thing. Because if you look at the relevant section of this document, it says, once you are a state party, you shall not manufacture, export, import, do all these kind of things, and therefore you make those offences. And whoever therefore does not comply with that commits a crime, which is therefore punishable through a normal process. The second question that has been asked, it talks about, by a member of parliament, it talks about when last did we use this definition and cost and methods. But I think, lastly, if you can just give a formulation answer on that, why I said you do the other questions. There's a history that you require, Chair, and I'll take advantage of that. Okay, the last thing. The other question by a member of honorable member of parliament asked the question of what is the impact of the position that we're taking in relation to class ammunition in the face of these terrorist organizations that are currently happening. Are we not opening ourselves up, therefore, to some challenges? Firstly, our answer lies in our commitments to the principles of our international humanitarian law. If you are to be a country, you always aspire to a particular dispensation, and that dispensation is that war should be fought because sometimes it's necessary to fight. But in the course of engaging in combat, you shall therefore subscribe to certain principles that shows responsibility. And you shall therefore use the weapons of war, which are therefore discriminate in nature and does not cause unnecessary injury and all of it. So if you look at that, for South Africa as a country, the military has had a careful consideration of this aspect. Whether in whatever kind of a combat theater they find themselves in, will they still find any utility of military utility of class ammunition? And the answer is that no. Our war strategy eliminates this as a weapon of war. However, then, in the event of you being faced with a person who uses them, that is a question that probably would therefore arise. So we therefore deploy other kinds of weapons. Because cluster munitions can therefore be countered by other weapons. If you therefore know how the other party is therefore coming, then I think Kenelafri can therefore touch on that on countering cluster munitions. But the problem here therefore with terrorist organizations is that by their very nature, they are not guided by principles of humanity and all of that. They are not. Even if you are to deal with them, you do not therefore stoop to their level of being nasty. Currently, we've got ISIS that is raging in the Middle East. They are engaging on tactics which are very barbaric, if I were to say that. Do you therefore degenerate yourself to the level where you also do exactly like they do? You don't. Because you've got a particular value system that you uphold, and that value system that will translate on the tactics and methods that you therefore engage. But I think I may not be able to adequately deal comprehensively with that, but in my view is that you can still be able to counter those who use cluster munitions. Obviously, the treaty says a country is allowed to train on tactics of destruction and this and that and the other. So you can still have a unit within there saying, yes, that is trained on dealing with this kind of thing. So that is that solution to that question. And the other question asked by the Honorable Member of Parliament opposite me here is about, it took so long to come to Parliament and certification, why? The problem about ratification is that it has to go through certain various departments. The cluster munitions, therefore, after negotiations and commitments and all of that, we spend some time in the Defense Department trying to check whether is it right to continue with this. What are the other measures that we can therefore put into place in the event of us being faced with this particular situation? One, but two, therefore, you get disrupted but you've got intervening general elections. And general elections, by their very nature, they are therefore very, you've got this particular leadership, and when this, another leadership comes in, you've got to start afresh and bring them up to speed and all of it. So I think we've been caught around that. But on the question of the 8 years, is an allowed period. It does not therefore mean that you have to destroy them on the last year of the age. So you can destroy the weapons or the cluster munitions immediately on the first year of ratifying, and that is the intention that South Africa has. We are not going to wait until the 8th year to destroy them. I accept the point that we concede to that point. Of destruction that if you delay it, you are actually bringing about an increase in the cost of our food. So I think we shall move with speed to ensure that the destruction does happen. Can you give me the question of when last we used that and the cost and methods?
I'm on the technical side and I have not really been on the operational side, so I'm not quite sure. I'm a military engineer by trade. I spent my military career building roads. But I can only imagine that it would have been during the winding up of the Southwest African campaign in the peace war, just before the peace process. I should imagine that is the last time they were used. In other words, during the war with Angola and in those final stages of winding up that war. That's all I could probably surmise. But if one could Google it, I could maybe find some more information. As to the cost of destruction, the figure of 2 million that was arrived at was an estimate that was generated when this went through cabinet process. I think that was last year. And in that process, they re-looked at the figures and they came at a 2 million estimate. But it's an estimate, and these things are you cannot really give a concrete costing on that. How they're destroyed, and ammunition management people have standard procedures for destroying ammunition of any shape and size. And this is just another item that they destroy. Typically, I would imagine that they would do it is like they alluded to me that they would effectively just destroy it through mass destruction. What they would do is put a large volume of explosive over the whole bomb, where all the cluster munitions are, and detonate the whole thing. And one of the ideas was to fill it with liquid explosives to make sure that all these sub-munitions inside all receive the impact of the shockwave that's necessary to disrupt them. So there are various methods, but the ammunition technical corps will know exactly how to deal with it. And they don't seem to have a big problem destroying these things. It's like one big bang at a big party. and the artillery shells is the same idea. You would basically put explosive charges on them and then just destroy them. And it also leaves you with the least pollution, because in the high temperatures of an explosive blast, all the poisonous chemicals are also reduced in the high temperature back to their basic elements, which are liberated. So you have very little pollution in that type of thing. That's all I can give on that. I don't know if I need to answer any questions on terrorist use. If these fall in the hands of terrorists, your terrorist needs to have an aircraft to be able to find the target and drop it on it. So he needs a delivery platform. And not many terrorists, maybe, even if they might have got hold of some of these, would be able to deliver them from the air onto a target. And the other thing that they would need is artillery. And the moment the terrorist has artillery, you can destroy that with relative ease. Yeah, I hope that answers the question on that side.
Another follow-up.
Thank you, Chairperson. Actually, the new question. Thanks for the response. Even though it's not an issue, I really personally, I don't take it as an issue. I know there are processes, but as a director responsible or as an official responsible, you have your SD. You have your measurable and your key performance areas, and you must weigh your responsibilities on your timeline. So I just accept it as it is. Now you'll try to move with speed. Slide number 35. I don't know whether I'm unable to read my constitution correctly. If you look at section 27 of the constitution, maybe it's a misprint or what, because section 27 doesn't speak to the item above. I don't know, maybe I don't read it correctly, or it's a miss, because you were preparing to come and give a presentation. But this one and section 9, it is totally different topic. It speaks about total, it's on municipalities, the formation and all those things. I don't know if maybe my this booklet of mine is not right, or your presentation is not right. Maybe you can just go and check and do the right thing. Yeah, section 27 of the constitution deals with municipalities. I don't know, maybe check.
Actually, Mr. Tappe is just making a confession. I would not necessarily wish to dispute the statement by the Honourable Member of Parliament. I think what we're trying to say here, and we could have quoted the wrong section, we concede to that. What we're trying to say is that in the event of us having to deal with victims of class elimination, we must ensure that we treat them with fairness, with equality, and proper right access to health. So we could have therefore quoted a wrong section of our constitution. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Any other questions? If not, allow me, Honourable Members, to proceed to item number. Oh, yes. Honourable Members, we need to approve or reject this. How do we approve it or do we reject it? Honourable Jose Shobujan.
Thanks, Chairperson. In the light of information shared with ourselves and question being answered positively, I would move that we agree with the proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member.
is there any opposing or rejecting? We are all in one. Thank you very much. Is there any seconder for that? Second. Thank you. Then let's move and over again to you, Department of Defense, to take us in this item number five. United Nations Arms Trade Treaty.
The Arms Treaty, which is a recently adopted United Nations Convention or Treaty, that basically seeks to regulate trade in arms. The difference, therefore, between this convention or this treaty and the one that we've dealt with now is that the class ammunition one prohibits the use of class ammunitions. However, this one, therefore, does not prohibit anything. All that it does is says you are to regulate the movement of arms. In the process of allowing the movement of arms, you are to apply a particular standard of care and scrutiny before you can. So it's about regulation as opposed to prohibition. I think that is the major difference that we have to just upfront in the case. But then in the course of the presentation, I'll introduce the subject as indicated in that presentation. But two, we would, again, just in passing, refer to the constitutional provisions and how that relates to international agreements. And thirdly, we would look at how we related, how we defined the position of South Africa when we engage in discussions and negotiations. Also talk about what will happen after ratification. And conclude, therefore, by also highlighting the key provisions of the treaty that we think are very pertinent and how we are dealing with them. Because the proposals that we are placing on the table to deal with this treaty are a little bit different from the one where we shall have a legislation being enacted. Here we say there is already a legal framework in place which shall therefore be used as a mechanism to give expression to the provisions of the treaty. But I shall therefore expand on that point as I come to it. The point here for on introduction, slide number two of that, I'm referring to that in 2013 last year, the United Nations therefore through its relevant resolution adopted this particular ATT, Arms Trade Treaty, and I shall therefore refer to it as ATT. That's how it is known. In the UN and all the same parties, they refer to the ATT. However, at the time of adoption, I think it was after probably about close to 6 years of discussions around the treaty. It took some time for this to come about as well. But in July 2013, the cabinet approved that South Africa should sign the treaty. And obviously, in terms of the constitution, yeah, the executive therefore can deal with that question. And however, cabinet also therefore approved that the ATT should therefore be introduced or tabled before parliament for ratification. So we got an endorsement from cabinet to come over here. And on the strength therefore of the cabinet approval, the president last year during the General Assembly meeting signed the treaty on behalf of South Africa, and we're excited when that basically happened. South Africa became one of the first few countries that would sign this particular treaty. However, you maybe just to define what the ATT is, the point that I've referred to previously. The ATT is a legally binding instrument that seeks to set our minimum standards for regulation of our international trade. And it sets up these particular standards because it seeks therefore to eliminate the diversion of arms to the wrong hands, as well as try to prevent a situation where these arms are therefore in the wrong hands and they are used in a manner that causes humanitarian suffering, humanitarian disasters and all of that. So the treaty therefore is very key on that particular point. And it is again, by virtue of it being a treaty, it constitutes part of the international law, which therefore deals with this particular question. what we're saying for slide number three, Jay, is about that this treaty, it is a very brand new treaty. It will, in terms of its provision, section 22, article 22 of that says, the treaty shall come into force 90 days after the 50th member or state has deposited instrument. What that says, Jay, is that any treaty sets up a threshold of countries. As an example here, for this treaty to be operational internationally, you need to have 50 member states signing and ratifying it. Because the ratification part actually says you are assuming your obligations under the treaty. Signing alone is not good enough, but the ratification is the main thing. So in terms of the provision of the treaty, therefore it says once the 50th member signs, therefore the treaty becomes operational. And therefore countries can therefore enlist as the year progresses. The latest information that we have, therefore, we've just been advised about that this morning by Foreign Affairs, is that as of last week, there's already 52 countries that have ratified, which basically means that this treaty is already in force. And we are happy about that, because at that level, therefore, it has been adopted. And obviously, therefore, when we come and ratify the treaty ourselves in South Africa, we depose our instrument, we shall therefore become probably country number 57 or 58 or all of that. But still, it places us amongst the first core or group of countries that are at the forefront of it. And I think from a foreign policy perspective, I think that aspect is absolutely very, 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 very key. However, then, when it comes to a country, once you ratify, the treaty therefore takes about 3 months before it becomes applicable to you. If South Africa ratifies today, you have to count, therefore, 90 days. And after 90 days, it should be fully effective. And that is why the whole issue of putting into place mechanisms to assume your responsibilities ahead of time is very key, because 3 months may be very limited if you have to put up an infrastructure to manage your obligations. Slide number four, therefore, talks about the issue of the constitution as well as the agreement. And I think we have discussed that once we're discussing the class ammunitions, but we just to restate the fact that also this treaty, the arms trade treaty, Article 21 of that, has got a provision that says this treaty is subject to ratification, acceptance, or approval by each signatory state. It means, therefore, by the admission of the treaty itself, it recognizes that there are domestic processes to be followed before ratification does happen. So that's why, therefore, we are here. Once we have done so, once Parliament has ratified, and therefore we shall proceed and therefore deposit our instruments of our ratification. And therefore the obligations will therefore be, without exception, be applicable to South Africa. The point therefore that I wish to raise when it comes to slide number five and six of the presentation therefore is about what made us to actively participate in the negotiations for the UN, for the UNACP? And there are quite a number of considerations that we had, Chairperson, and I think we are different. The one consideration that we had is that we were guided by the provision of the Constitution to say, look, there are certain, as South Africa, there are certain inviolable rights that are right under the Constitution. There are certain imperatives of the Constitution in terms of Section 231. And whatever thing that we do internationally, it must be guided by those provisions of the Constitution. And I think that was the biggest consideration that we had. But the other consideration that we had, Chair, was that we are, as a country, aware that the trade in arms lends itself to across the border trade. Arms, largely, if you are doing international trade in arms, they are exported between countries. It's an international trade. And if you are to get into international trade, what you want to have is to have a common understanding of the business that you are in, so that the instruments as well as documents and all of it that you use, all of you have got a common understanding of it, so that when you talk about a thing being a problem, everyone understands it the same way. So South Africa, therefore, because of our understanding of trade in arms, we understand how difficult it is to deal with a country where they may not understand some of the documents that you may call for. So therefore, we felt that common standards for trade in international in arms it was very critical as a consideration. Much as the whole issue of illicit trade, South Africa is concerned about illicit trade. Illicit trade happens when all these illegal people who act illegally trade and sell arms without authorization. That's an illegality. And that illicit trade, therefore, is in the stage of the world, and South Africa wishes to join those who are applying effort towards eliminating that, because we know that once illicit trade happens, there's always human security problems, there's always international peace problems, there's a risk to international peace, and South Africa, therefore, upholds its commitments to France. And the other point that was a consideration here is about our understanding of the responsibility of the industry as well as government. South Africa in an African continent, South Africa has got the biggest defense industry on the African continent. And if you've got such an infrastructure in South Africa, which exports most of the time, you've got therefore to be able to understand that there is a responsibility factor that comes in. As a country that exports, you must have certain standards to apply when you are exporting, because you are not only trading within South Africa. The government therefore becomes absolutely important to that. But the other part here, which is the considerations, then was the capacity of the state to execute arising obligations. Signing of treaties and ratifying them, it is a good diplomatic exercise. But what is even a better diplomatic exercise is to sign, ratify, and therefore execute the obligations that you've committed yourself to. The majority of times you find that countries sign treaties, but they act differently. So you need, therefore, to stay the course, commit to principles, and live by those particular principles. But because of that, therefore, we felt that we were of the view, South Africa was of the view, therefore, that these are the considerations and therefore we participate in this. And the state law advisor, before we signed the treaty, obviously as required by law, has therefore made an assessment of whether the provisions of the HET are consistent with South African domestic law. And the answer that they gave, therefore, was that it is. And I think the submission that we made to place on record before Parliament indicates that there is a consistency between the two. So there is no conflict that arises. And therefore, the signing, therefore, was informed by all these particular considerations. And again, therefore, slide number 7 and 8. We'll speak about the after ratification event. Once we have ratified the treaty, what happens? What happened in the first instance here is that there shall be a ratification instrument deposited with the UN Secretary General. That is a requirement, and we shall therefore do that through the Department of Foreign Affairs. And secondly, 90 days after ratification, the treaty therefore will come into force on South Africa. Automatically, after 3 months or 90 days, the treaty therefore becomes effective. You are therefore expected as a country to perform and conduct yourself in line with the provisions of the treaty. But the third bullet that we are raising there is a point that I will spend a moment on, enabling legislation. That section 231 says you have to domesticate the treaty, and we accept that. However, we are saying the requirement therefore in this instance to basically talk about enabling legislation is not 100% applicable. And we are saying so, therefore, because we had done an analysis. And the analysis of legislation that we've done, therefore, actually says to us, it has therefore revealed that we've got currently in South Africa a legislation that can actually be a vehicle through which, therefore, to deliver on the obligations under the treaty. There are two of those legislations, but the primary one is the NCEC Act, the National Conventional Arms Control Act. That act actually talks about or deals with the regulations of arms trade, export, import, transit, brokering, contracting, and all those. So if you are to ratify the treaty, you already have an infrastructure in place to deal with the obligations. Our assessment at the time was saying that already the infrastructure that we have of dealing with arms trade is much more onerous than that which the ATT calls for. Just to repeat the point, Chairperson, our standard of scrutiny of arms trade is higher than the standard that the ATT calls for. So we are already in a better position than what the ATT calls for. And therefore, that's why we are saying there shall be no requirement to therefore establish a new act that deals with this act, because we already have got such provisions already in place. What we are making as a point in page 8, on page 8 of or slide number 8, is that during the analysis, we asked two questions. One, is there present a legislation? And the answer was yes, we have. We've got the NCECS and of course the Firearms Control Act. Just for a moment on the Firearms Control Act. The NCEC Act deals with conventional arms. Conventional arms, by definition, are weapons that are used by military, are weapons of military application. However, the Firearms Control Act deals with commercial firearms, like your 9mm, you know, we all know that. Those are commercial firearms. But the treaty, therefore, I would expand on the scope when I come to it, that the treaty deals with conventional arms on the one hand, and to some extent with small arms. And therefore, the two legislations, therefore, are firstly present, and secondly, they are adequate. On the adequacy test, there is a positive conclusion, because they are adequate to basically deal with that. Therefore, we are saying, much as we understand the provisions of the Constitution in relation to enacting legislation, we're saying that is correct. However, in this instance, may not be applicable because we already have an infrastructure in place that can deal with the obligations. The other point, therefore, is the obligations, therefore, shall be expressed as just discussed now. So that is the post-ratification process. I would expand here on the point about how we're dealing with the provision through the legislation that we currently have. But that is in the subsequent slide. Well, maybe I'm coming to it already, because slide number 9, therefore, talks about the key elements of the ATT. Article 1 of the ATT, which is basically setting out the object and purpose of the treaty. It therefore says the object of the treaty is to establish common minimum standards for arms trade, and that we subscribe to. And secondly, it prevents the eradication of illicit trade, and I think we have discussed that point before. But if the two therefore are achieved, you shall therefore be able to promote international peace and security, prevent human suffering, as well as promote state responsibility, cooperation, and transparency. That is what Article 1 of the treaty therefore says. And we are saying, these are the principles, we bind to these principles, and we live by them, as evident in the legislation that we already have, which I've referred to in the previous slide. Article 2, therefore, of the treaty, talks about the scope. Chair, what the scope is here is about how far you cast the net. Any treaty has got a particular subject matter. The subject matter of the ATT are basically seven categories of weapons plus light weapons, small arms and light weapons. So the treaty therefore covers a particular set, because if you are defining international law or any other law for that matter, you've got to be specific and create certainty that this is applicable to this. You don't want to create uncertainty. It must be specific to a particular thing. So the ACT, therefore, is specific. It regulates, it deals with, one, the issues which are called here, battle tanks. It deals with armored combat vehicles, large caliber artillery systems. It deals with combat aircraft, attack helicopters, warships, missile launches, small arms and light weapons. So that is the subject matter of the treaty. But the activities therefore that are covered under those particular categories are exportation, importation, transit, transshipment, and brokering. It therefore says that if you are to export one of these things, the chains, missiles, and all of it, you are therefore required to observe the provisions of the treaty. If you are to import, if you are to allow through your jurisdiction a transfer of weapons, therefore, you are to honor the obligations. So that is the subject matter. So there are certain categories of the UN conventions In the UN, there is what is called the United Nations Register of Conventional Arms, which covers the seven categories that I've spoken to now. But on the other hand, that over and above that, you've got small arms and light vehicles. So in the nomenclature of the UN discussions and negotiations, what you were saying was the scope of the HTT, therefore, come is a 7 plus 2. 7 plus small arms and light vehicles, which makes it 7 plus 2, which is about 9 categories. But what the treaty does not have to do, it therefore excludes the movement of arms for purposes of states engaging in a particular conflict. As an example, if South Africa is to move, the SANDF is to move weapons to DRC to engage with N23. Those weapons, rifles and other equipment, they remain under the ownership of the SANDF. They are not exported, they are not being given to the DRC government. They are used by our own soldiers over there. After the operation, they shall come back to South Africa. So the treaty therefore shall not be applicable under those circumstances, because we accept that by nature of their work, soldiers go to theaters of conflict in the various parts of the world with their own equipment, and they shall come back. So the treaty therefore specifically excludes those particular circumstances. But how do we deal therefore with these provisions of the Act? Of the treaty in South Africa. The NCAC Act, or the National Convention Arms Control Act, has got a Section 15. Section 15, therefore, not Section 15, maybe, I'm just saying, the Act itself, if you look at the object of the Act, it therefore deals with the items that are indicated over here. All the basic things, combat aircraft, attack helicopters, warships, missiles, and all of it, are subject matters of the National Convention Arms Control Act. So if you've got obligations pertaining to those, you shall therefore use the mechanism of the NCAC Act to deal with them. And that's why therefore we're saying there is no requirement for an establishment of a new legislative framework to deal with this, because they are already being dealt with through the current legislation. And therefore, you've got section number, or Article 5 of the Convention. It basically says, once you are a state party to it, you shall therefore be required to establish and maintain a national control system. You must have control lists to implement the provisions of the Act. And we're saying, we already have that. In South Africa, we've got an arms control system that deals with export, import, transfer of arms. Already you've got a system in place, and therefore there's no requirement to put up a new one, because you already have one. And you also have got a national control list. If you look at the NCAC Act, which I've got a copy of here, you shall therefore find a control list, which therefore has got quite a number of things that you control. You shall not export this without this license and this license and this license. So that therefore constitutes what is called a national list. So our submission therefore, Chair, is that the regulations of the NCAC Act and the Act itself are good enough to deliver on the obligations of Article 5. The other provision of Article 5 therefore says each state party shall designate a competent authority in a country to deal with it. We're saying already for the National Convention Arms Control Committee that deals with us. And Chair, you will be aware that the NCAC, as it is called, is a committee of about 10 cabinet ministers who are appointed by the President to oversee the exportation and importation of arms. I am the secretary of that particular committee. So the licenses of export, when you see arms being exported through our ports of entry, they do so because they've been specifically licensed by the NCAC, and obviously we become the mechanism of actually doing that. So our duty amongst others is to regulate arms trade in South Africa. When arms go denial, export or import, they do so on the strength of our license that has been given. So we are saying there's already a national competence to do that, so there is no requirement to establish an alternative one. And then we come to slide number 12, which talks about prohibitions. The prohibitions, therefore, are that the treaty provides specific arms transfer prohibitions. What they are saying, in the event that you want to export or import arms, or to a large extent export arms to a particular destination, there are certain things that you need to take into account. And if those things are present in the destination that you want to export to, those may constitute a prohibition. Those may prevent you from exporting them. And one of them are, if there are UN embargoes against a particular country, you can't export to that country. You can't, because the UN has been possessed by a resolution. There is an arms embargo. You recall, Chair, that in 19 previously, South Africa was under a UN arms embargo in the 80s, and because of apartheid and all of that. And therefore, no country in the world was allowed to export to South Africa. Those who exported, if that happened, were actually breaking international law. Right. So if you are a responsible member of the international community, if there is a UN embargo on a particular country, you should. Let me make an example, Jim. There's a UN embargo presently on Syria. That's fact. Then South Africa is a responsible country, does not export arms to Syria because there's an arms embargo over there. And secondly, so where there is a likelihood that there shall be commission of genocide, where there are crimes being committed against humanity, where there are grave breaches of Geneva Conventions, where there are checks against civilians, where there are no protections of certain infrastructure, you can't export. So it basically means, by implication, it is prohibited to export to those particular countries. Therefore, the question that arises here is, how will South Africa deal with this particular requirement in terms of its own laws? And we're saying the NCEC Act therefore deals with that. Section 15 of the NCEC Act therefore says there is a guiding principle. You shall not export to a country where there is a UN arms embargo, where there is terrorism, where there is likelihood of genocide, where there is, so there is already a framework that basically deals with that. When there is a license that is given for an exportation of arms to those particular countries, it happens because that checking, this process has already happened. So we are already delivering on this. That's why we're saying our standards of arms control is already higher than that is called for by the treaty. Slide number 13, Chair, talk about risk assessment and mitigation. Article 7, 8, 9, and 11 basically deals with this question. And in summary, all of them are actually saying, in the event of, if you are to consider a possible arms transfer authorization, states are required to conduct a thorough risk assessment and determine appropriate mitigations. How do you do a risk assessment? You therefore look at those prohibitions. Is there an arms embargo? Is there a likelihood of genocide? Is there a check on civilians? Is there a human rights violation? Is there this and that and the other? And that is a risk assessment because there is a risk of these weapons being used for a wrong purpose. Right. But in the event, therefore, where you find that there are these particular risks, you've got to take mitigation actions. One mitigation action could therefore be to say, no, we are preventing that risk from materializing. Or you can begin, therefore, to engage with the prospective importer of your arms to basically say, we are not going to export to you until such time that we have addressed these particular concerns that we have. So those are mitigation actions. And we are therefore saying, Chair, the functions of risk assessment and mitigation are currently carried out under the auspices of the NCECC. Chair, just for the information of the committee, Minister Hadjeb at the present moment is a member, is the chair of the NCECC. The deputy there to be Minister Pando, and the Minister of Defense, Minister of State Security, Minister of Police, Minister of Foreign Affairs, or DICO, are members of that particular committee. So there is already a balanced perspective that is taken by the NCECC when we're dealing with this question. And our duty, therefore, as the secretariat to that, is to ensure that all the relevant risk assessments are done and submissions are made to the committee to make a decision. So, Chair, therefore, our submission, therefore, is that these provisions are already executed, as of now, even long before ratification. What the NCECC does, Chair, in the process of doing risk assessment, if you are clear that Section 15, which talks about all of these genocides and all of that, are not arising, you therefore approve that these arms can go. But in the event where you are concerned, you still want to engage the prospective importer, you place them on hold. You say, we are not taking a decision, we are still having to establish this particular fact and this particular fact. But in the event where there is a UN arms embargo and these risks are so high, you therefore say, no, we disapprove, we deny that. So So, Chair, therefore, these are matters that are already dealt with. So, Article 7, 8, 9, and 11 of the treaty are already taken care of. Slide number 13, or slide number 14, Chair, speaks about reporting obligations. In terms of the ACT, you are therefore required, as a state party, if you are a member, to provide annual reports to the UN in terms of what is your national legislation to deal with it, what are your control lists, what are the countermeasures you are putting into place to prevent diversion. You are required on a yearly basis to do that. And also provide reports about what is it that you have authorized for exportation last year, and importation and all of it. So all your activities are reported on a yearly basis. And Chair, therefore, are saying these obligations are the obligations that we are currently executing. On a yearly basis, the NCHC, through the offices that we come from, prepare this report, take them through to the NCHC, and they are tabled here before Parliament for ratification. Every year, Chair, on a quarterly basis, the NCHC appears before the Portfolio Committee on Defense and other committees to account for the arms transfers conducted. And we are required, therefore, by law, at the present moment, to submit such reports, therefore, relevant reports to the United Nations. So if the AGT calls for reporting mechanism to happen, you're saying, we already have that, we are doing it at the present moment, and there's no requirement to put up any new infrastructure because the current one is already in place. The way ahead, Chair, which is my last slide, it's almost similar to the previous one, that what happens after ratification, how do you move ahead? One is that the instrument therefore shall be deposited with the Secretary General of the United Nations by GECO, and the treaty therefore shall kick into force in South Africa 90 days after deposition of the instrument. But we're saying those obligations are already done, and we shall therefore execute the prohibitions, the provisions as required. Participation, therefore, obviously, arms trade is very international. We engage with many of the state parties on conventions on a yearly basis, and the three members here are always engaging in these kinds of activities. So, Chair, what we are saying here is that there shall be no development or submission of a new legislation to speak to the provisions here. We're saying the current infrastructure is sufficient. In fact, it's much more onerous than what the AGT calls for. So, Chair, therefore, in conclusion, therefore, our submission is that we request this committee to support the ratification of the treaty. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Over to you, honourable members, any clarity and questions?
If not,
honourable members, thank you. Honourable Tobijan?
Yeah, it's not necessarily about the substantive issues of the presentation, but it's about the constitutionality imperative of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, which it always calls for public participation. In this component that they are requesting us to give them ratification, what are the measures that are put in place to make sure that the South African populace are aware of, you know, this kind of, you know, laws that we are ratifying on their behalf? Where do we see the public participation as, you know, specified by the Constitution? That's the only area that I thought I need to be, you know, settled on it. Thank you very much.
Hello.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is with regards to according to the presentation that South Africa was the first one to sign the ATT, and then we presented that about the threshold of 50 countries supposed to sign. Just one for interest to date, how many countries have already signed the ATT, so that we know what are our partners in this process.
Any other member? Need a clarity, eh? Pay you over to us, eh?
Thanks, Chairperson. Let me give you the first question asked by your honorable member of parliament around the issue of participation of the constitutional imperative, as it were. Chair, when we were in 2002, when the NCCF, the National Convention Arms Control Act, was established, there was a consultation process, therefore, that was embarked upon by the Department of Defense, DECO, and other relevant parties to ensure that everyone who was part of, who had interest in that, was aware of what we were intending to do and how we were intending to do that. And in 2008, therefore, there was an amendment of the same legislation with, again, SOTA to consult on such. And even during the time when this legislation came to Parliament, Parliament had therefore called upon public participation sessions, where all it was open to about every member of society to come and attend. And I think I was here with other colleagues of mine, where we engaged with quite a number of state parties, but members of society and organizations, NGOs and others, on the provisions of this. Chair, we therefore accept, though, that the nature of arms control lends itself to interests of particular sectors of society. You will therefore find that from the Zulu province where I come from, in my rural village, and I think if I were to talk to some of the people that I grew up with, they cannot understand what this is about, and it's not part of their interest. But when I'm in Pretoria, where I say the population that is there seems to have interest in this kind of matters. But I think therefore we therefore find that in terms of attraction, the people who were therefore attracted by the invitation, either by Parliament or by ourselves, to participate in these activities, will therefore be those who have got an interest in this particular matter. But we have tried our best. We continue to have outreach programs. Last year we had two outreach programs. In one in Pretoria CSIR, where we sent out invitations to members of our society to come and engage with ourselves on some of the applications of that. And obviously, again, you've got a particular return of people. But there is an attempt to try to ensure that everyone does understand what arms control is and how best they can support that. The second question that has been asked by the Member of Parliament is about the numbers of countries that have joined the treaty, as articulated in slide number 3 of that. One is, as I said, as of yesterday, the information that we got from DECO, Department of International Cooperation and for Foreign Affairs, as it were, is that there are 53 countries now that have joined. And within the African continent, there's Nigeria is one, and there's another one, I've just missed that. So South Africa will become a third country on the African continent to join if we do ratify. Obviously, others are largely from the other parts of the world, Europe and the Middle East and somewhere else. But on the African continent, I think there's about two right now, and South Africa may become a third member to join over there. But we are talking now about those who have ratified them, and I think I need to because there's more than 100 that have joined, just signing, and signing is not good enough. But those that have ratified are 53, according to the latest information that we have. Thank you, Chairperson.
So in those countries, it's Russia, U.S. are part of signing.
The West and the East. Chairperson, I must say, I would not wish to go on record on that. I'm not too certain. But all that I can know is that during the negotiations, and I think during the negotiations in New York, I think it took some time to convince the Russian as well as the U.S. Delegation that there was a need for this. And it took some time for them to come to the party. I'm not too sure they signed. I'm not too sure whether they've ratified. And I think I can establish that. But I wouldn't like to go on record.
Don't you think that we'll be compromising our state if we sign, not checking those big countries that they signed it? because I'm worried because we're in our time. In fact, United States and Russia, they tried to be the world police and tried to be. We are not, can we? You cannot put us in their trap if we can rectify before we check those two giants of the world. Don't you think so?
Before you can respond, I'm worried because of during the first presentation, it says that USA has not, pardon, it's not put up a stockpile. And I suppose they have raised eyebrows to you by then because of if they are not, they are produced, but now they are not part of the stockpile. Because those, I agree with what we're concerned. But your concern to me was supposed to be more on the one of them. Because they are produced, but they are not stocking inside you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The United States has signed it on the 25th of September last year, which is the same date as it we signed it on. They just haven't ratified it. But most of Europe seems to have ratified it.
But they were able to supply weapons
from India. Thank you. I'm covered, Chair. So I think it was last year, was it Neptune who would take over or support the what I want to know, because I knew that when Gaddafi tried to use the weapons, you are called, no, you are not supposed to do that. Then that NATO come up with the, is that because they were sent by the UN to use those weapons, or those weapons that they used by NATO against Libya was authorized? Can you get a question? That's a general question.
I think what I wish to do, obviously this is a very political question, but in response to that, is that the treaty itself, it's not going to determine whether you can attack X or Y. It's about how you deal with the buying and selling of weapons. And if that, therefore, is the case, South Africa at the present moment already have got an act that says, in the process of deciding on the sale of weapons, we shall therefore go through this particular process. Whether the ATC came about or not, we have already therefore subscribed to a value system of dealing with that particular question. So I'm not sure whether you want, therefore, to go back to ask whether, in the process of delivering on our own value system, we are to judge ourselves against others. I think that is a traditional question, which I would probably defer to the Minister of Defense.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Thank you very much, are we supporting or rejecting this, ladies and gentlemen? I want to know in terms of the United Nations Arms Trade Treaty. Is tabled in front of this committee in terms of section 2312 of the Constitution of 1996. I'd like to hear from the committee whether we are supporting or rejecting. Thank you.
Chair, in the absence of the I would like to support the ratification of the ATC.
Is there any member who supports that?
Yeah, Chair, through you, I'm seconding the latter speaker on, of course, approving or seconding to the presentation that has been presented to us. But, Chair, I'm just worried. It's a UN, eh? It's UN. No. I'm supporting you, but I'm worried that they cannot improve
it. Thank you, Aramza. Aramza, my second name. Thank you very much, honored members. Thank you very much, Department of Defense, for giving this opportunity of us understanding exactly what happened to our defense. And I think you will keep on coming to this committee, assisting where we don't understand, we make it us to understand. Thank you very much for giving this to participate. Thank you very much, sir. I think we can release the Department of Defense. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Bye.
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 Just to advise you that the next meeting is scheduled for time, so we have got very limited time to deal with this. Can they be?
It's 5 minutes left. I think we have got minutes here. I think we have got copies of this minute. We need to adopt those minutes. Is there anyone who has got a problem with the minutes? Another member?
Chairperson, you started with the question of if anyone was approved with the minutes. If they are approved with the minutes.
Okay.
I'm saying your question, please, you have minutes, and want to check if anyone has a problem with the minutes.
Yeah,
we'll see. So, Chair, I would like to start with them to raise the issue with regard to the minutes.
Yeah.
I don't understand why are we always getting the minutes during the meeting. But with regard to the presentation, we get the presentation well in advance. But the minutes, we only receive them every time when we're in the meeting. And that's the reason why we always defer the minutes to the next meeting. And through the next meeting, again, we receive the minutes on the day of the meeting. And this minutes already, I have perused them. They're inconsistent with the programs in the minutes themselves. I've checked the minutes, if I can make reference to the one minute related to the minutes of the 15th of July. Yeah, we have 5 sets of minutes. So I want to just make the reference to the minutes of the 15th of July and the 28th of July. 15th. And the minutes of the 28th of July. You see, in the minutes of the 15th of July, it says that the minutes will be requested the minutes will be published at the next meeting. Is how we are raised. So I just want to qualify what I'm raising that. That at the 15th, on the day of the 15th of July, we receive the minutes and we raise the issue that we receive the minutes on the day of the meeting. Yes, that's why we are unable to engage in the minutes. Again, on the minutes of the 28th of July, it says that on the minutes of the, according to the program, the minutes says 4.2.1, the minutes of the 15th of July. But when you table the minutes, there's no 4.2.1 in the minutes themselves. So I'm just raising the two main sets of minutes that perused. I wonder to other sets of minutes what is going on. We are requesting that sometimes as members, we'll be told that these things that we need training. But I'm asking myself, because officials are being here, what is the problem with the officials? To ensure that they prepare for the meeting and be able to ensure that they put their minds when preparing the minutes for the meeting. That it's either they don't take us serious or they don't take their work serious. They are our support staff are supposed to ensure that we do our work diligently and take our work serious. I'm making a appeal, Chairperson, to the meeting, to yourself as a chairperson of this committee, to seriously talk to your team to ensure that when coming to the minutes, they provide us with the minutes, so we'll be able to ensure that we peruse the minutes. I'm not confident for us to engage into this minute. I'm not sure if this minute are the correct reflection of the minute, of the meeting. This is an appeal I'm making. Thank you.
Thank you, honorable member, and thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I completely agree with my colleague. I also want to show you an example of, I'm not quite happy with, well, the 15th of July, it sets out very clearly what each member asked and what our questions were and what their replies were as well. The next minutes of the 16th of July, when you, for example, go to point 13, members' interaction with deputy minister, it just gives the minister's reply. It doesn't give my question to the deputy minister, setting out exactly the points that I made to him, only his replies. If the minutes start reflecting only the reply of the minister and not the questions that have been asked by members, he can answer whatever he likes, and his sugar-coated answer will be reflected in the minutes, but not the point that we try to make in the meeting. That is of some concern. I get the feeling that the 15th of July, we still had the time to put in everything quite clearly and in detail. And then from there on, it just became easier just to put the answer in. I don't know. But I would like to see that the questions and the answers be minuted properly as they were in the 15th of July. That's just a request that I have, but I completely agree with my colleague.
Thank you. What do you suggest? Can we adopt those minutes then for then the official will rectify, or do you want the person to come back again for correction? Yes, honorable.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think the, I hear what members are saying, but there is an issue that we would have to engage on besides the minutes, the documents. The issue is that what kind of format of the minutes we're agreeable to. Whether we use resolution-based capture the record, or we use verbatim, what is that? So I think it's a matter, Chair, that we'll have to engage amongst ourselves. And I think, fine, because I think in the fourth term, for instance, there were resolution-based minutes. So this being the new term, we might have to engage into what is the preferred position in regards to that. So it's two issues really, to go and correct this document, but also in principle, say what are we amenable to in terms of this record that we want to create. Thank you, Chair.
Sorry for again. And you, Honourable Chairperson, it's interesting that the Honourable Mandy says that we had a resolution-based method in the past, whereas all the earlier minutes have been formulated in this way, where they say what every member has asked. All the minutes that we had before 15 July, and including 15 July, are done on this basis. It's only from 16 July then we have a shorter version where it's not put out in that way. I would really request that it makes it a lot easier to know from where and what the question was instead of just including the answer. So, I mean, they don't have to say who asked the question even. They must just say what is the question that the minister is replying to in the other minutes. It's been done from 15 July all the way backwards through June and May when we started. Why all of a sudden from 16 July it has to be a lot shorter?
It is just unfortunate that we don't have time, but I guess we cannot have minutes that you know we should be under the universal acceptable standard, which would say when you are talking about an issue, the minutes should reflect on the committee deliberated on this matter and this is what happened. We cannot have the minutes that are like repetitive, which about demand is that, Tavajan is that, it cannot. Let's deal with it. Can Chesterton emphasize issues of discipline here? I cannot talk and other people talking at the same time. So I'm not going to be able to allow that unless you want me to defend myself. Like they were talking, and I did not like what he was saying, but I couldn't, you know, stop him. I allow him to stop, and then I came back. So I'm saying, let's take what is universally acceptable standard of minutes, and then not the one of talking about ourselves and then all this.
Can you put in the mic, brother? Yeah. So on the way forward, do the same consent. I'm hoping that we stand it down and we get a proper proposition of minister at the next meeting and we deal with that first. So even if you want the committee conference earlier and deal with the minutes, then you have it done and dusted. Because right now, I believe that some of us in this house who are not happy with the way the minutes have been presented. But instead of arguing with each other, we're taking more time and some of us have to go to another meeting after this.
Thank you, Bill. Actually, we agree that the minutes must be standardized. That's all. Thank you very much. Honorable members, I think
we need to face this current issue correctly. To say the minutes should be ratified, but should be how it is, should not refer to an individual.
Now, well, let's move, guys, because there are people outside there. I think we're supposed to get a direction for next week. What are we going to do for our oversight? Sister, do you have a list? Can you tell the committee?
The Joint Committee has received approval to conduct oversight next week in KZN, in Upper Pulusi, Mvoti, and in Babazani. And we're just presenting the program. It is a draft program. There's still final meetings to be arranged, some on caucus side and some on petition side. And we will then tie down everything today and give you the final program by today.
We agreed that the minutes will be submitted in the next coming meeting, but now we're talking about our program of oversight next week.
Are we not part of the program?
No, we agreed that after the meeting we will deal with this, because there are people outside there. I think we finished all our programs. Now we are coming for our own. This is part of the committee.
Hello.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the meeting is adjourned.